Anderson in San Diego.
In golf, there is now a three-way tie for first place at the Masters Tournament in Augusta, Georgia. It was a very windy day during the second round yesterday, with gusts as strong as 40 miles an hour. Only eight golfers finished with rounds under par. At the midway point, Scottie Scheffler, Bryson DeChambeau, and Max Homa are tied for first at 6-under. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Jones Day, an integrated partnership collaboratively providing legal services for more than a century. 42 offices, 5 continents, serving clients as one firm worldwide. Learn more at jonesday.com.
What a lovely morning here on the Augustana College campus. Friends, you're just in time for a conversation with this week's guest, Brian Leach, Chair of the History Department at Augustana College. I'm Kai Swanson. I hope you'll join us here on Quad Cities Public Radio as we while away the hour, check in on the composer's datebook, and who knows what else, all on Saturday Morning Live, portions recorded. So I learned something today already, and that is that my guest, Brian Leach, is one of those folks who really appreciates the Saturday morning theme music.
Somebody asked him.
Well, I am grateful that you do, and I am grateful that you're here. So, Brian, you are an historian, and right off the top, so is that a British affect to say an historian, or should I say a historian? What do you prefer?
I've always said an historian, but I think most people now say a historian.
Okay.
It always makes it feel like you're saying ahistorical, which is bad,
because
that's against
thing.
History,
that's
so
right.
I don't want that. So I go an historian just to make sure I'm, pulling those two things apart.
Well, and this whole enterprise I find fascinating because I studied a fair amount of history in my own background, but it never dawned on me to try to pursue that as a career. So I want to get to that in just a second. But for starters, tell me about where you grew up and when you first started to get interest in telling stories.
Sure. Yeah, so I grew up in Montana. I'm from Bozeman, Montana, which is a pleasant little college town, which has now grown quite a bit since I originally grew up there. But I grew up the son of professors at Montana State. They were music faculty, so that explains a little bit about why I got into college teaching. And I'd say, there are a number of kind of origin points for history other than always having been interested in it. But one thing is that they had this great historical journal still exists. A lot of states have their own state historical journal. There's a lot of them are quite good. The one in Montana, the Montana Magazine of Western History, is both an academic journal where you have serious historical work, but it's also like a pretty glossy magazine, right? So it has pretty photos and pictures. And so I would grab that off the news rack and read it. It was like my favorite magazine when I was in middle school and high school. I think I had always kind of thought about being really interested in the history of the places that I was at and in. And so not necessarily, it wasn't even really like big world events or anything. It was like just like what happened here where I'm standing. That was kind of my origins for being really interested in history. And so, I think that was kind of early starting points, which also brings me, I think, one of my proudest moments in my career was when I got published in that journal, right? The thing that you, it's like when you're reading, Highlights Magazine or something, and you get, published. It's like, your childhood dream, right? True, right?
I still have the first letter to the editor and only that I sent to the Chicago Tribune that was published because it was in response to a humorous column that Mike Royko, their great columnist, did about how dour Swedes were and humorless. So I wrote an entirely humorless response, and they published it. So that's I know what you're talking about. But let's get there then. So you grew up in Bozeman, which seems like just a great place to grow up. It would seem.
Mm-hmm.
Did you stick around in the Big Sky State for college? Did you travel? What did you do?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I went about 2.5 hours away to Missoula, Montana, to the University of Montana. So
right.
I just went to the other state school, which was a great choice. I often find when I'm here at Augustana, I get a lot of students, you know, from the Chicagoland area, about similar distance, right? It makes sense to me as college.
Right.
You can go home if you want to, but you don't feel like you have to be at home all the time. So yeah, no, it was a kind of perfect experience. And you know, I think because I was so interested already in the place I was in and growing up, it felt like a good match.
Well, that's what I call laundry distance.
It's about
far enough away to, you know,
yep.
Get some laundry done, but also a beautiful setting. I've only been through Montana on Amtrak, so I got to change that at some point. But you and I have a mutual friend now in Missoula. Steve and Jane Balls are living there, so we'll figure out a way to sneak out and see those guys at some point. So you went there and I assume majored in history? Did you start to develop? Because when I studied history at Augustana, it was very different times. It was in the 80s, and I became captivated with Russian history. We taught a lot more about Russia then because it was the preeminent competitor. Then, of course, we went through decades of pivoting to China, and our history department has done that very well, political science elsewhere. Now I'm kind of thinking it's time to study those Russians. Well, it's a study in psychology nowadays because it's all about Vladimir Putin. But I got captivated by Russian history. Was there something that caught your attention in terms of a topic or broad area when you were an undergrad?
I would say I was really interested in two things. One was essentially what we'd call kind of Western history. I was interested in the history of the American West. So that meant a lot of different things to me. And then the other thing was a subject area that I essentially now teach in, which was what we call environmental history, which, you know, the history of essentially people's relationship with nature and the environment. And so that was both kind of how, you know, people affect and change nature, but also how nature changes stories. So, you know, easy examples would be things like you could study the Civil War, but what about how did weather impact the Civil War? Muddy roads, you know, that kind of thing might be one way that you might think about it, kind of the nature affecting change on a kind of a human scale, too.
Just in the course of my lifetime, seeing the evolution in that relationship, right? And in my own lifetime, it was adversarial and, you know, nature is something to be defeated. And you would look at stories from history like the Johnstown flood as an object lesson in the vagaries, right? And did we learn anything when we started to constrain the Mississippi? Certainly not. It was all about constraint, right? And then to see through the 70s and 80s, a gradual awakening, still and always has been a political issue, but now we're looking at the fact that, no, nature's our partner, and if we don't take care of our partner, we're facing it right now, the extreme weather events and more floods. I've lost count of how many thousand-year floods I've witnessed here in the River City, but I imagine you get a lot of interest from students in that course.
Yeah, and I mean, you're right. The subfield of environmental history kind of grew out of the environmental movement. And so a lot of it was really interested in kind of those politics at the time. And so there are definitely a lot of students who come at it from that angle, right? They're interested in environmental politics, policies. Some of them are coming there because they're interested in environmental sciences, right?
Mm-hmm,
so,
mm-hmm.
You know, we have a lot of students certainly who are interested in sciences and biology. And so it makes sense to them as a way to study history. So yeah, you definitely get a lot of students coming at it from that angle. And I think there's other students who are just kind of curious about kind of an unusual new way to look at events that otherwise seemed familiar, so that you're able to kind of see places where nature intercedes, or you know, maybe that there are things that we forgot, which were really important. You know, it's easier to see big issues today, transitions to different new energy sources today, are kind of easier to understand when you think about transitions to mineral energy sources in the 19th century. So when we stopped using, you know,
whale oil
and, you know, like all these kinds of things for you know, energizing and kind of making things go. And so, yeah, I think you can kind of see, oh, well, actually you could make new decisions about energy in the environment, but just by looking at the past.
Right, right. I find that fascinating that nowadays, I mean, sometimes I'm very much in despair about what's going to be the environment given to my grandchildren. But then I realize that there are all kinds of areas of research where we're trying to find new ways. Mm-hmm. And of course, we still have that subset that is resistant to these new ways as they were to giving up whale oil. Yep. But so I want to know when you got the article published, where were you in your journey? Were you still in school? Was that after grad? Or
I think that was, I'm trying to remember. I think I maybe just finished grad school. So I was here at Augustana teaching.
Okay.
I don't think I could make it to the unveiling of the article or whatever. But I remember being able to kind of celebrate from here.
Was it about mineral extraction? Because I know that's been an interest for you.
Yeah, I'd say, I mean, a lot of my research specifically is about, I guess, maybe natural resource industries. And mining is maybe my first interest / love. It was about a story about a big, large open pit mine in Butte, Montana, and about essentially people in Butte trying to negotiate what to do with a industry that was both vitally important to their city's functioning and making them an important place in the world. And also, it was this pit that was kind of gradually eating away at their homes, right? Kind of right. Making them relocate. And so it's kind of it was the story about this kind of forgotten protest against that mine.
And that was an article, but you've also written a book about extraction in Montana, right? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, that article indeed was kind of drawn from that research. Eventually became a book called "The City That Ate Itself." Speaking of the metaphor there of consumption,
right,
that I started with. Yeah. And it's essentially kind of a story about the Berkeley Pit, which is a very large open pit copper mine in Montana. And it's both about kind of people having to relocate, but also this big shift that happened in mining industry from mostly doing underground mining to open pit surface mining, which has happened in most minerals kind of across the world over the course of the 20th century. And so a lot of it was also about kind of the changing work life, right? What was it like when you were an underground miner, which is much more dangerous, but also had a lot of kind of internal rewards. You had a lot of control over your own work life. You have less when you're in an open pit mine. But also it's a lot safer, right? So kind of about some of the negotiations that those workers had to do too.
I just heard from a friend this week she's got a family member who is involved in the, pardon me, the reopening of a copper mine in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was pretty much mined out in the easy extraction early 1800s, and they're coming back. Is that happening globally, that we're going back to sources with new extraction techniques?
It happens in a few cases. Less likely. I mean, it's mineral by mineral, and you know, it also depends a little bit on what they're going to do and how they're going to do it. But you're right in the sense that we have a lot of technologies now where you can essentially kind of remine areas, or go through what we call the tailings, like the waste from a mine, and go back through it, right, and reprocess things, because we're able to kind of pull out those little minuscule bits now in a way that we weren't in early days. And you're right, I mean, Michigan in some ways is a good example where, I mean, there were just enormous chunks of copper just sitting
just
like on the ground.
Pick them up. Right.
And that was, you know, so that made it really easy in the early days. And then, you know, a lot of later mining of things like copper was where they're, it's very widely dispersed, but because we had better processing technologies, ways to concentrate it and then smelt it into kind of a better substance, right? We've been able to do that. But yeah, gold mining, similar kinds of stories where we've used, you know, all sorts of new solvents and things to help get out those little tiny minuscule bits.
Yeah, right. You know. So I'm captivated by the journey so far, but it's been pretty much lodged in Montana. So what drew you to get out of that beautiful country and then eventually land here?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was an academic journey in the sense that I decided I wanted to go into history. I got into graduate school at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. So I moved there to the Midwest, and I guess I haven't left since. I used to say I got marooned here, but actually I'm very happy to be here. Yeah, so I went up there and spent a number of years earning first a master's and then working on my PhD at the University of Wisconsin, which weirdly enough has a long-standing reputation as one of the places to go for both the history of the American West, which is one of the foundational places where that discipline was kind of created, and environmental history. So it kind of ended up being a perfect place for me.
It's interesting how that happens, because there was a guy who was at one of the satellite schools of the University of Wisconsin named Cary Trask, was a historian, and he wrote a great book about Black Hawk. So,
book.
Yeah, the way that all works together like that. So, okay, you get to Wisconsin, you get that PhD, you get all these things coming together. How did the Quad Cities get on your radar screen?
I was moved down here by my wife. So my wife followed me to Wisconsin, and then it was kind of her next turn to make the move the opposite direction. So she wanted to go to graduate school too. She decided that she was excited by kind of holistic health practices and went to Palmer College of Chiropractic. So I moved with her down here, lived in downtown Davenport, one of the first kind of new converted loft buildings. Now there's a bunch of them. So I first got here for that reason. And the way that I got at Augustana was mostly that I was trying to find something to do while I was down here. And so I ended up kind of getting a couple classes, and then apparently they couldn't figure out how to get rid of me because I'm still here.
So when somebody asks for Dr. Leach, there's a moment of confusion there on the phone.
There
right?
can be sometimes, yes.
Right. Well, friends, my guest is Dr. Brian Leach, who is chair of the history department at Augustana College. And we're going to step aside for just a moment because, you know, one of the ways we celebrate history is through anniversaries. And I don't know if you knew this, Brian, but there's some really big anniversaries today. One that I can think of in music, one that I can think of in literature. We'll save the latter for later. Right now, here's the composer's datebook.
This is the composer's datebook for April 13th. I'm John Burge. One of the best loved works of classical music, Handel's oratorio Messiah, had its first performance on today's date in Dublin in the year 1742. Handel wrote Messiah in a period of only 4 weeks, then put it aside until he received an invitation to present a new work in the Irish capital. Dublin gave Messiah an enthusiastic reception, but it took a few years before London recognized that Messiah was a masterpiece. Baroque composers like Handel freely borrowed materials from previous works or even other composers. For Messiah, Handel borrowed melodies from his Concerto a Due Cori. The American composer Ellen Tafe Zwillick harks back to this Baroque custom in her own Concerto Grosso 1985, in which she quotes directly from Handel's Violin Sonata in D, which, in turn, quotes from no fewer than four of Handel's own earlier compositions. Born in Miami in 1939, Ellen Tafe Zwillick studied at Juilliard and in 1983 became the first woman to win the Pulitzer Prize in Music for her Symphony No. 1. Composer's Daybook is produced by APM, American Public Media, in collaboration with the American Composers Forum, reminding you that all music was once new.
The history of Handel's Messiah is woven into this joint thanks to a professor who later became president named Olaf Olsson. He decided that it was the most amazing music he'd ever heard while visiting London, and he brought it here to the Quad Cities in 1879. It's what prompted the creation of the Augustana Orchestra for no other reason than this one professor wanted to hear the Messiah, and they didn't have Spotify in the 1880s. So he had to do it that way. Friends, my guest is Brian Leach. We're going to get back to history in a moment, but I want to tell you that support for Composer's Datebook on WVIK comes from the Quad City Symphony Orchestra, where access meets inspiration. Learn more at qcso.org. But there is so much going on in our community today and tomorrow. Friends, if you're looking for something very close at hand, Dorothy Goes to Oz and Snow White. This is Ballet Quad Cities at the Adler Theater today at 2 and 7. Two one-act ballets and one unforgettable performance. Act 1 begins in Windy, Kansas with Dorothy and her friends. And let's see, Dorothy Goes to Oz is that one because fairy tales are not just for children. There's also a brand new sophisticated interpretation of Grimm's Snow White by artistic director Courtney Lyon. Perfect ending to a fantastic season of dance. Then that's also this evening. You could head downriver just a little bit to Muscatine for the Muscatine Symphony Orchestra's Red, White, and Blue concert. They're featuring world-renowned concert pianist Jeffrey Beagle. It's the premiere performance of Peter Boyer's Rhapsody in Red, White, and Blue. That piece was written as a celebration of the masterpiece, of course, Rhapsody in Blue by George Gershwin, written 100 years ago this year. And it's a way to bring all of America together following COVID-19 with music. So that's at Wesley United Methodist Church in Muscatine. Check the Muscatine Symphony Orchestra website for more details there. And one more thing, there's a couple of colleagues of Brian's and mine that'll be celebrated tomorrow at 2 o'clock in Augustana's Wallenberg Hall, a celebratory recital celebrating the career of Dr. Janina Ehrlich, professor of cello at Augustana College, including a brand new work by Dr. Jacob Banks. It's called The Quarrel Between Winter and Summer. And Brian, we just celebrated Dr. Banks as well with his our local premiere of his work, The Clarinet Concerto, which was phenomenal and will be on these airwaves in about a week, I think.
Yeah,
we do a rebroadcast. So there's way too much stuff to do in the Quad Cities.
There is.
Go figure.
Yeah.
So, well, you and I were talking about history and about how sometimes it aligns with personal interests. You had these interests in the environment and the American West, and they all sort of came together. And then that lands you here on the west coast of Illinois. And in teaching, you're going to have to teach a lot of other subject matter. But how is it when you find students share that interest in the environmental and West United States West history?
Oh, well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, I think I run into some students today who were, actually increasingly we'll run into students from Colorado in particular who will have a lot of interest already kind of in the mountains and what might have been happening in the American West. So that certainly is kind of nice. But I would actually say that one of the fun things to do is that because environmental history kind of grounds you in a place, right? Mm-hmm. And that really the kind of approach is that you care deeply about whatever place you're in and what you're thinking about, what you're looking for, that it's nicely applicable for all students where I always teach that course. Like, well, what about right here where you are?
Yes.
What happened here in the past? What happened there before that? And what happened before that? And so even as kind of just a simple research question, I find that it gets students really engaged. And so often we'll do projects where we just, do things like take a little spot in the Quad Cities or even a spot on campus and let's just find old maps and photos and documents, journals written about that spot so that you can learn more about what happened there. And I find that kind of immediately gets people to start thinking about where they're just walking every day a little bit more deeply.
Well, and you, I happen to know because you worked with the Rock Island County Board Chair, Richard Brunk, and had some students look at the history of Courthouse Square. How did that come together, and where does the project stand?
Yeah, that was a really fun project. I mean, one of my favorite things to do with students is to give them kind of real-world research experiences where they're able to both do some interesting research, but actually have an audience beyond me, right? because I'm a not a very interesting audience. and I think they feel the pressure more. They put in a lot of really hard work when they know that they have a public audience. And so this is a project where the Rock Island County Board was interested in kind of developing this this new green space where the old Rock Island County Courthouse sat. And the idea is that they're putting in place markers, permanent markers around that space where different buildings stood and where different kind of historical events happened. And they were looking for folks to write up some content where you could click into a QR code and, you know, with your phone and tap on it. And then you go to a website and it tells you more about that place so that you don't have a marker that's four paragraphs long or something.
Right.
And so, yeah, I you know, I gave students that project. We worked with now retired Judge Mark Vanderweele.
Yes.
And kind of started with some material he had done some research on. And then we just spent time going to different places, Rock Island County's Historical Society in particular, and just kind of going through different files and folders. And so they wrote up little bits and pieces about, old court cases and about different jail structures and kind of hilarious pieces. There was, people like a prisoner who escaped and then they caught him because he was just selling ice cream cones at a park, things like that. So there are a bunch of kind of fun stories that they uncovered and put together. I, as far as where that project is, I think currently we're doing a little copy editing on it. But I'm hopeful that we'll have that up in place in the near future.
I hope, now that you mentioned, I should get Judge Vanderweele here on the show because I've learned so much local history from him.
Yeah.
And the shenanigans that went into the selection of the city of Rock Island as the county seat when Hampton was making a very strong case that involved some firearms and drinking, lot of drinking, is a great story. So, but I'll save that for Judge Vanderweele. If you're listening, Judge, be prepared to get an invite at some point. But I love the fact that you got your students involved, and this will be something fun down the road. They'll come back maybe for a homecoming and then step over and check those QR codes and hear their work there or see their work in place. So that was really kind of cool. What other things have you, what has surprised you that students have found interesting in these projects of local history?
Well, it's I'm always interested to see what students kind of get really engaged by. I mean, one project that comes to mind from that question is I was once doing a project through the college's Upper Mississippi Study Center with this Sustainable Working Landscapes Initiative, essentially where we kind of pair up with different local governments.
Oh, it's a great program.
Yeah, and the idea is that kind of the college students and professors serve as consultants to those groups, right? Doing kind of works that you would hire consultants for. And one of the projects we did is we worked with the Clinton Public Library in Clinton, Iowa, so just about an hour north of us. A beautiful little community, and they had asked for students to do oral histories, and one of my favorite methodologies is doing interviews with people. And so they wanted to do this project looking at a strike, a very important strike at the Clinton Corn Processing Company, which is one of these corn refineries, a major corn refinery, which is now owned, I think it's an ADM operation, but it's still there. And there was a strike in 1979, 1980, really divided the community, and the library director was interested in learning more. And so we... students got in there and started doing interviews, and I would say the thing that kind of engaged them and got excited was something that I wasn't expecting, which is that people are still upset, right, about this event that happened, many years ago. And I think that made them kind of, understand, just that valence, like just how important that past can be to shaping what happens even now, right, in the present and in the future. And so they got really engaged by that project and made kind of short little documentary pieces, which were really fun that we were able to share with the community. And I think got some people to start talking about an event that many of them had kind of hidden in the background, that I think they hadn't wanted to talk about it. But I think it was some kind of therapeutic nature to that conversation.
Yeah, I want to talk to you about that because, the way we tell stories to ourselves, the way we, narrate those stories, I mean, it has so much to do with psychology, right? And you're not a psychologist, and it's the gift of the historian that you don't have to get that involved. In fact, you shouldn't. You're looking at this objectively and academically. But I can think of examples in my own life where things that were maybe traumatic, depending on how I tell the story, will be therapeutic. And I'm glad you used that word. And I can tell the story in a different way. How do you help students see that? I mean, because you could talk to two people back to back in Clinton, and you can fill in any example who observed the same thing from just maybe a different point on the compass and had very different conclusions as to what happened. How do you prepare students for that?
Well, I think that's really tricky. I think first off, you're right, is a starting by explaining to students that, all of history is stories and storytelling, so that they are already kind of looking for the markers of stories and storytelling. And then I think you're right. The second is to get a good sense for them explaining, like, how do you identify, essentially people's approaches, their own kind of biases, but I also, accept those biases as being perfectly valid, right? That just, everyone's biased in some way, right? And so certainly understanding that they have their own context, their own background that led them to kind of approach things that way. Mm-hmm. So I think just kind of starting with like being very kind of, empathetic, right? And that, there are multiple ways to see any event, I think is really important. And that, that doesn't necessarily mean that one person is always right and one person is always wrong, right? But there's usually truth somewhere in there.
Yeah.
And then I think you're right. Like, then once you kind of approach, your different subjects, it's maybe even more meaningful when you're doing like an oral history, you're doing an interview, right, where it's, you're, face to face with the person, right, that you kind of need a kind of historical empathy, right, for what that's happening. But yeah, I think you do that with all different kinds of sources. So I think you start with that. And then the next thing to do is indeed kind of talking about, well, what do you do when stories conflict? And how do you kind of help yourself and other people kind of work through that? And that I think that differs by situation.
And of course, with the Clinton instance, that was decades removed, yes. Right? And of course, I can't help but think of more recent examples. Like I, as an elected official, have been confronted by people whose view of what happened on January 6th in Congress is shaped by very heavily edited, selected images of white Christian nationalists praying together in the rotunda. Whereas if anybody's watched The Frontline, very comprehensive with, sourced video from, will realize that it was an attempted insurrection to interfere with the workings of Congress.
Yeah.
And yet, sitting in the county board chambers in Rock Island, I have to hear from this group that claims that the objective video evidence is not true, right? And they believe that. So I don't know that the historian has any agency in this, but what happens when the story that they're telling themselves is objectively false and merely palliative? I don't know. What do you do?
Yeah, I think that's really tricky. And you're right. There are people who make careers based on, studying kind of public memories and ways that people kind of develop memories. You're right. Sometimes, obviously very influenced by whatever media they're imbibing. But it's also true that communities kind of like gather around one way of seeing an event and just decide that that was the way that we should see it. I'm kind of reminded of a historical example. I was just listening to an interview with a historian, Peter Bogue, who wrote this book about Pacific Northwest violence, essentially in the Pacific Northwest. And one of his explanations, essentially there was lots of Native people that were slaughtered, pushed out. He even used the term genocide. But, right, a lot of these settlers over time, right, started telling themselves a story about this being kind of a necessary violence, and then they started kind of hiding the violence behind these discussions of pioneering, right, and that this was kind of like just part of that natural progression and process. I think in some ways when that becomes an issue, sometimes you have to confront it, right, and say, like, here is... maybe these stories you've been telling yourselves are not necessarily true ones. And, because I think there is something important to be said that they're, pursuing that historical truth, which is so important for historians especially, but it should be important for a community too, right? It's hard to move forward. It's hard to pick a good path, right, if you don't know what the actual truth is. It doesn't necessarily mean that you have to be upset and angry about each other all the time, right? But I think knowing what's true certainly does help you make better decisions about different communities and places.
You're reminding me of a great quote from one of my favorite columnists. He was a very conservative columnist, Michael Gerson. I don't know if you ever read him.
Michael Gerson.
And by happenstance, he went to college with a guy I went to high school with here in Rock Island. So he was a college classmate of Bill Mott's and some other guys. And he said, The discipline, and that's the key word here, the discipline of history teaches us to engage with discomforting, distressing ideas without fearing them.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I'll tell friends, yeah, I studied history at Augie, and the constant joke is, oh, yeah, what good did that? Well, it did me a lot of good because it taught me that, and that's a, I don't think we're teaching history well in the primary, secondary, and I think there's a lot of remediation then that happens in the post-secondary because of legislators getting involved, right, in secondary education. But that discipline is what's so important about studying history. It's not about the conclusions. It's about the methodologies.
Yeah.
Right?
That's really true. And, you know, to meet your quote with a quote, I mean, one that I sometimes use is one of the founders, kind of modern founders of the discipline of history, Leopold von Ranke, the German historian, you know, he had this belief that to do true history, and he kind of looked at history as being, he tried to make this a more kind of quote-unquote scientific discipline, but what he really meant was, you know, there are these three things you had to do. One is that you had to have kind of like a compassionate understanding of people. Two was that you needed to be true and honest, right? Pursue honesty and truth. And the third one was courage, right? You had to have the courage to pursue that truth and then use that truth, to kind of the advantage of the community there, right? So I agree. I think there's certainly something to be said that what the discipline of history teaches you is how to suss out the truth, right? No matter what you're looking for, and that truth is itself an important thing.
Well, my guest is a very courageous historian, good friend of mine, Brian Leach, the chair of the Augustana History Department. And Brian, it's actually coming up in 20 minutes before 11 o'clock. I think the temperature is well into the 60s now in the Quad Cities. I cannot remember. It was either Herodotus or Roald Tweet who said, one must never let the facts get in the way of a good story. I mean, probably it's a close run thing. But anyway, we do matter. History matters here. So I'm going to give everyone a quiz who's listening right now. The music we're going to hear this morning celebrates another anniversary, not of the music, but of the novel that inspired it. Okay, so that's your one hint. There's a novel that appeared today in 1953 that led eventually to the music we're about to hear. And I want people to kind of guess for yourself, just write down your answer, we'll trust you, if you can guess where this was originally aired. Now, it gained some currency later from a sketch on Saturday Night Live, that other show that refuses to say, you know, portions recorded, though clearly they are. But it was one of the greatest sketches with Will Forte. And I always wondered where this came from. So, friends, if you know, lock that answer in your memory, and we'll have the quiz right after this.
Thank you.
Okay, it's quiz time, friends. So the hints were this was used in a hilarious Saturday Night Live sketch with Will Forte, and it celebrates a novel that appeared on this day, April 13th of 1953. And with a little bit of prodding, my guest, Dr. Brian Leach, got the answer, and that is, that's the theme to the original Casino Royale. And I never knew that watching Forte, but Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass performed that recording. And I think it's hilarious that that was the first Ian Fleming take on James Bond. The book came out on this date in 1953.
It's fantastic.
And you said you were quite a fan.
I was, yeah. I watched that movie multiple times when I was a kid. Because when I became obsessed with James Bond, I was pointed at this movie because I also, found things like Monty Python very funny.
Of course.
So they just handed it, my parents just handed it. They're like, here, you need to watch this. And so I did many times.
Well, now, we've been talking also earlier about things that are going on in the Quad Cities in the next few days. And next Wednesday night, I want to lift up the fact that you, in addition to many other things, are the president of the Augustana Historical Society. And the spring program is coming up Wednesday night. If I'm not mistaken, it's free and open to the public. Please give us details.
Yeah, it's free and open to the public. April 17th, 7 p.m., Professor Emeritus of Geography Norm Moline from Augustana has given a talk in the Lindbergh Hall, and it's essentially about the history of Asian studies at Augustana College as kind of one of the first introductions of like a non-European, non-American curriculum to the college. And so I think it's going to be fun to hear from him. He was around for a lot of the early steps and stages, as well as kind of helped lead it into the kind of more recent iterations.
Sure. Yeah. And I wish I could go. I'm fortunately not going to be able to attend that, but it's a great history. So it goes back to 1905 when the denomination that Augustana was associated with opened up a mission in northeastern China. And then it grew from there, highlighted, many think, by a young man from Wuhan or north of Wuhan, Daniel Tsui, who came over and finished his education here, then went to Princeton and got the Nobel Prize in 1998. One of the things I'm sure Norm, and I had classes with Norm, will talk about is that Augustana was one of the first schools back into China because of those old ties, going back to 1905 after Nixon and Mao met, and that rapprochement allowed for Augustana students to get over there. So it's true that stories really do create powerful opportunities for us to this very day. We had talked earlier, though, Brian, about I had pontificated, whatever, about people interfering with the teaching of history in the secondary level. And it reminds me of a quote by someone who I don't normally think of as an historian, Brené Brown. But she said, when we deny the story, it defines us. And when we own the story, we can write a new ending. What's your take on that?
Oh, that's a beautiful quote.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah, no, I love that idea. I think that's it's a really apt way to put it, right? That one of the important things that you can do by understanding your history is indeed figure out a new path forward, right? If you pretend like nothing happened, or that nothing significant or serious or bad or even good, right, happened, I think you end up often leaving certain communities, different people, in the dust, right? That they, if their story was not represented, I think that's important.
Well, it's the founders told us it was the point of the exercise when they were writing the Constitution in order to form a more perfect union. Which immediately takes away the idea of having perfection and then you can go hang up your cleats and go home.
Right.
It's, so I think that's an imperative thing. But it's about this way that we try to tell these stories to ourselves. Do you find, because you're a parent as well, you have some lovely children, how does being an historian help or hinder you as a parent?
I don't know. That's a question I've never even thought of. Does it help or hinder me? I think the you know, there's probably a particular way of approaching the world that is both good and bad, in the sense that I think my historical mindset is to be very calm and measured, which can be usually a benefit as a parent, but also sometimes means that maybe I need to be a little bit more, step in earlier sometimes. But
well, the reason I ask is, I mean, yeah. I made every possible mistake as a parent, and then learned from a few of those now as a grandparent. And one of the things I see is it's a part of our job with the littlest members of our family to try to make sense of things. But then as they mature, also prepare them that a lot of things just will not make sense, and they have to be comfortable with ambiguity. And for a historian, I mean, I think that's a special lens to look at that that exercise.
Yeah, ambiguity is important, and you're right, being comfortable with it. And I would say, I mean, one of the, you know, maybe more direct lines of I think is there's also just kind of important ways to think about teaching your family about their own roots, right? Whether it's the, you know, the kind of history of their own community, the history of their family, right? Like, you know, that genealogy helps you feel kind of connected both to, you know, your own past, but to your family members, right?
Sure.
You know, grandparents become something more than just old people who sometimes come by, right?
Yeah.
And they become, you know, kind of important links to yourself.
That was just on This American Life, that notion that we wish we could have known our grandparents when they were younger, right? And I found that to be very interesting. Mm-hmm. What is the advent of things like genetic research done for your students' curiosity about themselves? I mean, in some ways, it might seem to have enhanced it.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I think some students certainly have done things like, you know, done those little saliva tests or whatever and sent them off.
Right.
And I think there's a way that it makes kind of a quick and immediate, you know, way to tap into your own personal past that was not available previously. I think in some ways, though, a lot of them aren't, they're not doing that right now. I feel like, especially kind of that kind of genealogy and that particular interest in your personal past seems still to be something that people get interested in more as they get older. But I would say that because they're so aware of that being kind of a method and methodology, mm-hmm. they're not a surprise now when I bring up things about, like, here's ways that people have tied certain, you know, ancestors to this or that, because it's you're right to say it's kind of become well known.
And I think there was a story in the New York Times this week. I did not read it, but I saw the headline that a lot of these genetic testing programs are creating uncomfortable truths that people have to confront.
Yeah, it's
so
true.
We'll have to keep an eye on that. You know, this being an election year and talking with you about story, I mentioned that I just stumbled on an interesting observation from the writer Michael Lewis this week. He wrote, among other things, Moneyball. So obviously he knows how to weave a good story.
Yeah.
But I heard him say, unless you have a story, you don't have a way to persuade people. And that reminds me of wonderful interactions in the past with the theologian Martin Marty. Once I was with him in a visit here, and everyone he would meet, that's how he met him. He'd say, "What? My name's Martin, your name's Brian, what's your story?" So if I asked you, Brian, what's your story? What are you going to say?
Oh, no.
Yeah, that's right. I'm putting you on. This is it. You got the Casino Royale right, so I thought I could put you on the spot once again. But if somebody asks you, what's your story, how do you respond to that?
You know, I think the that's a very good question. Boy, I think when I would immediately, you know, I think you have to turn to one particular peculiar interest or something as a way to tell that story,
and that's
right?
Fine.
Yeah, you know, I think I always say something like, oh, you know, Western boy, from the mountains, now enjoying lakes and rivers. You know, because I'm so interested in landscapes. But yeah, I think that's an interesting way to put it. And, you know, and because places are so important to how we think about stories. One of my professors at the University of Wisconsin, William Cronin, has this really cool essay that I used to enjoy. It's called, like, A Place for Stories, where essentially he analyzes two looks at the Dust Bowl experience in the 1930s. And he's talking about these two different books, right? And one of them essentially portrays the Dust Bowl as this heroic overcoming of these, you know, farmers who had faced the worst. And, you know, so the story is about kind of like their noble, you know, undertaking to kind of get around this. And then the other book, so that's Paul Bonifield's book, and the other book is by Donald Worster, who uses the Dust Bowl to explain all of the worst farming practices and behaviors that Americans had gotten into to kind of ruin their landscape and cause the Dust Bowl. And it's always made me think, like, that's, you know, it's a really important thing to think about, like, the way that that story is told, then,
exactly.
You know, and I think they're both true, right? But the way that that story is told then teaches you something different, right? If you believe that the Dust Bowl was this horrible occasion that was caused by people and their poor practices, you would try to fix those practices, right? If you think it's about noble overcoming, right, then you'd try to also kind of celebrate those important ways that people overcame things. And both of those things could be perfectly good options to go on, but yeah. You know, you might get more benefit out of one than the other as a community.
Well, I know that the way that historians look at the native story in the Americas has changed a great deal. Also in my lifetime, because when I was a kid, it was, you know, bury my heart at Wounded Knee. And then now we just, our little reading group did the newer history, which was a story of survival. And mm-hmm. I'm blanking on that historian's name, the author's name. I don't know if that would come to mind. But anyway, it is a lot about how we tell the story and the lenses mm-hmm. through which we look. But, you know, as you were talking, I thought, well, how would I define Brian Leach's story? And you gave me the inspiration. I'd have to say a rangy Montanan who looks good in tweed.
How's that? That's good. I like it.
Or at least comfortable. Right. Comfortable in tweed. Well, I can't thank you enough, but I know you've got other things to do this weekend, and you're going to be heading across the way tomorrow and doing some fun things with students. Tell me about that.
Yeah, one of my favorite things to do as a professor at Augustana, I've been the one of the advisors for a student group that helps run a little small organic garden on campus called Augie Acres, although I don't think it's actually multiple acres. It might, I'm not sure, I don't think we even get up to an acre, but it's a couple old house plots, and we've got an apple orchard and plum trees and peach trees, and we've got berry bushes, and we've got beautiful raised beds. And there's a fairly sizable and excited and engaged group of students who are out there every weekend pulling things out of the ground and putting new things in the ground. And so it's one of my favorite things to do is to get out there and kind of experience that with them and figure out ways to grow things. We often, that produce, we've done all sorts of different things with it. Sometimes we sell it. More recently, we've donated a lot of it to the Nest Cafe
mm-hmm.
And to other places where they're in need of food. So.
I honestly didn't know. It never occurred to me that they'd grow plums in this area.
Yeah.
I always associate that with California and, you know, prunes and all that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah.
But no, we grow plums. And you said peaches.
Yep.
I know there's a peach has history here in Illinois and, of course, apples. Well, that's really cool. And the students do most of the work, or does Professor Leach have to kind of step in a little?
No, they do most of the work. Although I do remember going up for my tenure hearing and it being brought up that one of the people on the committee, the faculty review committee, had driven by Augie Acres at one point and saw me in a suit mowing the grass. And I don't know if that's what got me tenure, but maybe it was.
Well, with that image, I'm going to ride into this weekend. I would really love to thank our guest this week, Dr. Brian Leach, chair of the history department at Augustana College. And as you have heard over the last hour, also a very multi-talented individual. And invite you all, friends, to join us next week when our guest is going to be Wani Sarour. He's a Palestinian-American jazz artist here with Quad City Arts, and you're going to hear that right here at 90.3 FM and HD in Rock Island, WVIK that is, and at 95.9 FM K240 DZ in Dubuque. Now, whatever you're doing today, I hope it takes you out of doors, because we've got sunny skies, a high near 75 degrees, winds light and variable, becoming southerly at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tonight, partly cloudy, overnight low around 60. Tomorrow, gorgeous sunny skies with a high near 82. And then guess what, friends? After a sunny Monday, when we get to sunny Monday night, not so much. It's got a chance of rain Monday night all the way through to Wednesday, then clearing Wednesday night. Thursday, mostly sunny. A little cooler, though, to end the week, high near 58. And then Friday, mostly sunny, high near 52. In any event, I hope that whatever you do brings you a great deal of joy as you head outside in our beautiful community. And remember, friends, coming up in just a moment, it is, wait, don't tell me, one of our favorite programs here on public radio. That comes to us from Chicago, as Bill Curtis will always tell us, through the auspices of NPR, and then right back to your home. As my friend Jim O'Hara says, in the Quad Cities, we spell NPR WVIK. Thanks for tuning in, friends. Please join us next week on Saturday Morning Live. Portions, yeah, recorded.